Hello and welcome to the Virginia Woolf podcast. My name is Dr. Karina Yakubovic, and in this series I interview artists, writers and academics who've been influenced by the author Virginia Woolf. Today I'm at Pell's Pools in Lewes, Sussex. The weather is absolutely gorgeous, we've got blue skies, lots of sunshine. And Woolf's home, Monk's House, is just a few miles away in Rodmell. She very nearly moved to Lewes itself in 1919, after having impulsively bought a beautiful but incredibly impractical house, which she quickly sold before she had the chance to move in. I'm here with Tanya Shadrick. Tanya is a writer and publisher who began her career as an author by transcribing the stories of people in hospice care. She's since been a visiting writer in a number of extraordinary places, including Pell's Pool, Virginia Woolf's garden at Monk's House, and at the Jan Mikalski Foundation for Writing and Literature in Switzerland. Her first book, The Cure for Sleep, a memoir of a late waking life, was published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson earlier this year. So Tanya, we're at Pell's Pool, which is England's oldest outdoor pool, apparently. And I wanted to come here because it plays a really important role in the writing of your book. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes, and hello, Karina, and thank you for inviting me to take part in this. So Pell's Pool is here in my hometown that I've lived in ever since I came to Sussex over 25 years ago as an undergraduate of English literature at nearby Sussex University. So I'd come here with my children when they were young, but, you know, just as a mum of young children. But then when my two children were finally in school, and I'm 42 years old and I've wanted to be a writer all my life, become a point of painful urgency that I hadn't turned into Woolf somehow, as I thought I would just by coming up here to study near where she lived. It had become urgent, and I suddenly had one of those creative leaps that I think sometimes does come from constraint and difficulty, which is, what if I wrote my diaries in public on a grand scale? I was used to being here at the pool, so I decided to write a mile, because it sounded nice, and it's a length in outdoor swimming, and I decided to write on scrolls of paper as long as this pool that we're now sitting beside, which is a really big pool. It's 50 metres long, so kind of Olympic size. So I had five rolls of paper, each 50 metres or 150 foot long, and it took two springs and summers, and it's 100,000 words, it's novel length.
Gosh.
And it's kind of a diary, and it's also the stories of the swimmers and nature notes and a commonplace book as well of things I remembered as I worked here from Woolf and other poets. So it's a very strange undertaking.
It's strange, and in a way it's so in tune with what writing is, which is a labour and a job. And I think Woolf really understood that as well. You know, she would go back and forth to her writing lodge at Monk's House and work in a pretty regular manner.
Leonard called it stockbroker hours, didn't he? He said she kept stockbroker hours going between the house and the writing shed.
That's right. And I think it was important to her to find a place that was apart from the domestic home, a place that hadn't been inscribed with rules or roles in any way. How important was it for you to find somewhere that wasn't, you know, the place where you were raising a family?
Absolutely crucial. And this whole idea that's so often talked about, of, you know, what Woolf said about a room of one's own, it's just not an option for, it wasn't an option for me then. I do have a writing room at home now, but I didn't when the children were younger. There's no question of it. And no question of space or boundaries or solitude or quiet. So perversely for me, or interestingly, I think, actually, for me, as a mother of young children, my equivalent of that space Woolf got by going from the house to the writing shed, turning her back on the domestic, I got by going out into public. So I first began in 2013 just wanting to feel like a writer. So I'm using any spare minute to write in tiny little notebooks in my local coffee shop. And the noise was different than domestic noise. The dishes were not mine to clean. So it had the effect of privacy, even though I had to go into a public place to do it. And then, of course, it meant I'd built up those muscles of writing in public, which meant then I could make this really big leap into performance of that. But it was very much me trying to find, consciously, an equivalent of that space where the writing was key.
And I definitely felt that reading the book, that the work was an expression and in a way the equivalent also of making a big decision in your life, making a big turn. You call it a memoir of a late waking life. Could you tell me a little bit more about, without giving too much away, about the story that kind of led to that title?
So the kind of book begins with a very sudden and surprising change in my life. So I've had my first child 10 days earlier, normal emergency delivery. I'm not feeling unwell in any way. The midwife has come that very morning to our little house here, just one street away from where Wolf bought the roundhouse. So tiny little wren's nest of a house, and the midwife in that slightly patronising way, "Oh, how well you've healed, what a neat mend," and ignored my comments about, I felt like I was running too fast, like an engine running too fast, what would normal be if you're a new mother. Anyway, she left. Later that afternoon, my husband and I, because we were living a very strange life, a bit like Leonard and Virginia, actually, but before our time, we were in our mid-20s, but living like them in their 50s, deliberately. We wanted to live like them. We were congratulating ourselves on how well we'd absorbed this new life into our orderly one. And I reached for a book from a shelf, because my husband said, "Oh, we've got time to read, look." And the blood started, and it was huge and devastating, and I knew instantly I was pretty much dying. I wasn't in any pain, so it's very existential. And I think it was that fact, it was that it was so fast, and it was a very rare arterial hemorrhage. And so I almost died in the ambulance, which was just a street away. This is why I'm still here to speak to you, because I would have died in around 7 minutes, they told me later. And then when they realised it wasn't a normal hemorrhage, about 8 hours later in the hospital, began to die again. And that's when I was told they may not be able to save my life. Within the space of a day, I had these two really extraordinary existential experiences where I wasn't in pain, I wasn't heavily medicated. And so I was in different ways, first quick and then slower, told to contemplate the end of my life. And what I felt was real regret. On paper, I'd got a first class degree from Sussex and an MA, a British Academy scholarship. I had a good job at the university in a high level admin role, but I'd always wanted to be a writer and I hadn't in any way attempted that. That's what the book pivots on. It's you know, in my last minute of living, what I think is my last minute before they take me away to the operating theatre, I go back in the book and I say, where does it begin, this turn away from risk and adventure that so many of us have? And then with the first breath of my second life, the rest of the book is a forwards movement where I'm, how do you change your life so late when you're not going to walk out and go on a big quest or a trek, when you have got responsibilities in a small town to earn money to look after other people? Can you transform your life as an artist or whatever? So that's how the book works, really. Two big questions.
They're huge questions. and it encompasses so many significant life moments as well, this business of having a child, but also bringing creative life into the world and sort of giving birth to yourself, so to speak, through your own work. There's a piece of the text that I'd love for you to read, because it alludes to exactly what you were saying just there. It'd be really nice to give listeners a sense of what your prose sounds like. It's absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. Where does it begin, our turn away from risk and adventure? Why do so many of us hide in routine, shrink from opportunity? What I asked in that last luxuriate minute of living, my fear disappearing into wonder even as I was laid awake on the operating table. Where does it begin? What I ask again, in this story of my life before then and since. For if the events which wake us are sudden, what leads to a sleep of soul and possibility is harder to trace. We have to go back through all the tales told to us or by us about the world and its workings, that bramble thicket in which we lost our will and way.
It's a crucial question, I think, that many writers ask themselves, if nothing else, because they're creating a plot. And it's the job, I think, of so many fiction authors anyway, to create adventures for the reader so that they don't have to make that choice. They can stay at home and still go and slay dragons and so on. But when you're writing a memoir, or when you're writing life, and I think for many modern fiction authors, it's very important to perhaps sit on that boundary line between staying in your old choices and making new choices. I'm thinking, for example, of the character Mrs. Dalloway, who Wolf represents as someone who has made her choices. She shows the road that she took, the marriage she made, but she constantly alludes to the possibility of other roads, of other adventures, of lives unlived. And so what you get is this palimpsest of a story where lives that were lived and unlived lives and certain possibilities are all interweaving with each other all the time. I was wondering, to what degree did Wolf have an impact on your life as a writer and on this book?
It's a lovely question, and that idea of unlived lives is really key to my book, and that sensibility that Wolf has, I share that sense of multiple lives, as you see in Orlando, and also in The Waves, that sense of people constantly throughout their lives interrogating themselves in comparison to others. People often, when I was doing the scrolls here, people said to me, oh, is it stream of consciousness? It's an idea people have kind of, even if they've not read Wolf and some of the other modernists, it's come into our cultural currency, hasn't it? People who don't even read a lot will say, is it stream of consciousness? But actually, the scrolls weren't. They looked like a literal stream of words, but they were actually like more like musical notation. They were very precise because of the length I was working with, constantly rolling it up. Her sensibility was always with me, though. The Waves became very important to me, that sense of the cast of voices, the way in Mrs. Dalloway you go in and out of the different consciousnesses. I wanted to be really porous and not be the author hidden away, controlling the narrative. I let people in. And then a lot of that I wanted to bring forward into the book. However, I would say the book in some respects is deliberately, it's quite old-fashioned compared to how memoirs are being written these days. Memoirs today are quite fragmentary and lack a cohesive narrative, and I made a deliberate choice that just as Wolf's writing was challenging in her day, because she was breaking out of those big authorial narratives, for me, in the current age, when so many quite spare books with lots of white space and almost bricolage are being written, to me, it felt like the modern challenge is how can we go back to coherent narratives and life arcs that show the lived life and the unlived?
Yes, and while still being true insofar as we can be true, yeah, when we write, because we want to show that life is in essence fragmentary, but there is a need to kind of impose a certain unity, a narrative onto that for the reader's sake, and maybe for the writers as well, to sort of to put certain things in order, perhaps. You did go all the way to New York and see some of Wolf's diaries in person, her real diaries.
A real diary.
What was that like?
And that was back for my 30th birthday, so it's a full, 12 years before I break into a public voice of my own. And that was when my husband and the book makes clear I never wanted to be a mother because of a difficult childhood. I take the responsibility of other people's lives very seriously. And like Wolf, didn't want to be a mother. But my husband's a lovely man who I've grown up with since I was 20 and met him at Sussex. And that's the main thing he wanted for his life. We find out we need IVF, which makes it doubly challenging for me. And before the treatment starts, we decide to go somewhere because we're also scared to travel. So we've never traveled. And we choose America. And before I go, even my Sussex University email won't get me access to Wolf's precious diaries. They're very rarely accessed now, I think. I think even academics really struggle to get to look at them. But I persisted, was told no, and I turned up on my 30th birthday for my only 2 days in America, was told no again, and then the head of the collection came out, and there's a scene in the book where I'm asked, why do you want to see them so badly? And I have this moment to come up with this amazing lie of why it's really important. To their credit and mine, I said it was about, and it's interesting given I'm now known for writing on paper in public, because what I said was, when they said, well, they're so beautifully published in diary form, you don't need to see the originals anymore. And I said, well, I want to see if she writes with more fluency on the paper, pen on paper, when she's talking about writing or Leonard or the women she loves. And the curator looked at me and just went, you may enter. It was, and they knew it was a lie. But how interesting that then when I did become a writer a full 12 years later, it was about pen on paper and fluency and the actual practice of handwriting. So that's kind of lovely, really. The seeds of my future writing life was in that moment.
That's wonderful. She's there at the kind of the genesis of that project.
But as I say in the book, what propelled me there was this like magical sense of almost contagious magic, as the person who wrote James Fraser in The Golden Bough would probably describe it. This idea that if I touched one of her diaries, it would make me a writer. It was the same magical thinking that had led me to apply to Sussex at 18, knowing nothing about the university system, being rural and working class. And I opened the Sussex Prospectus, not even knowing where Sussex was, and it opened onto a picture of Virginia Woolf, and hadn't even read her at that point. So uneducated. But I remember thinking, that's the archetypal writer, that will do for me. If I go there, I'll become a writer too. And of course I did, but not in that sense of you show up somewhere and it rubs off on you. And it was the same with her diary. The minute I was sat in front of one, I realised I couldn't read her writing. It's appalling. It was so boring. And I'd made such a fuss that I had to sit there for a couple of hours with a security guard behind me looking like I was interested.
It is. It's very difficult handwriting to read.
It's the stupidest story of all time, really. What a waste.
Well, in a way, you kind of explained why it was important, because it is that materiality, that the conditions that produce art, and Woolf herself was really interested in this, and she writes about this a lot in A Room of One's Own, in the environment in which you work and the conditions under which you work, and the kind of bread and butter of existence that can make all the difference between an actual stockbroker and an author. And it's a really fine balance, and it will be different for everybody. But I certainly find, and I think my students find this as well, that the space in which they work is so vital to what they produce. Mm. And to have good paper, or to have a good laptop, or have good pens, yeah, is part of that. It's part of everything. And to lead on from that, to build on this idea of environment, I know that you did do a little bit of work at Monk's House in the garden. Mm. Could you tell me what that was like?
Yeah, and there's a key chapter in the book set there as well, which is really wonderful for me to have put that, to have kind of actually linked my story with Woolf's in a small way, both on the day I did the performance and also now in the story of it in the book. So I would have been there more often, but the pandemic happened. But there was this wonderful day in June 2019. It was the, I think, second or third National Writing Day in our country. So the UK had this National Writing Day that started in 2017. And I did the first one here at Pell's Pool, actually. I had children decorating the tree with words for water on streamers of paper and things. But in 2019, I was in Woolf's garden for the whole day. And I was set up on my little, because I have this kneeling table like a Japanese scribe, and it was outside her writing shed. And yeah, it was just magical, because I had people all over the garden writing letters to people, either to themselves or to members of their family. And then I addressed them all and stamped them with a Monk's House stamp, and then they got sent to people all over the world, because a lot of the people were visiting from America, you know, Japan, Amsterdam. You know, we had people from all over the world there that day. And it was really special to send letters out from her garden to these other countries.
It's such a wonderful place, a very creative place. Mm. Whenever I go there, there's usually at least one or two people looking very solemn, you know, like they, yeah, like they've just stepped, yeah, on sacred ground, mm, really. And I think for creators and artists and writers, that is what it represents for them in many ways. I have a little section of the book here, which I'd love you to read, that mm-hmm. describes you being at Monk's House, just to give people a taste of that experience.
Thank you. So this is a very short chapter called Stay This Moment, and I'll just read a little bit from it. A woman without feet. How I thought of myself at midsummer, still only half a year free from a lifetime chasing after scraps of love. And what a wonderful occupation for a woman not able to walk, to be holding court for the day in Monk's House, last home of Virginia Woolf. Earlier, I'd sat at her desk and been photographed, aware, even while my face ached with pleasure, of how unlikely the scenario, me from a class that would have made me her servant, the village girl who came in daily to empty the ashes, light the stove, sweep the floors, having to dip my knee when spoken to, as my granny Nell had to bob and curtsy for the squire who employed her as cook. Instead, visitors had begun to gather around my travelling table just outside her studio, waiting for me, the living writer, to speak. I opened her diaries and began to read in an accent so different to hers. If one does not lie back and sum up and stay to the moment, this very moment, stay, you are so fair, what will be one's gain dying? No, stay this moment. No one ever says that enough. Always hurry. I am now going in to see Leonard and say, stay this moment. And that was the theme of the day. It was stay this moment. And that's what people were doing with their letters all around the garden. And I have a little bit where I describe the people working there. And do you mind? I'll just do another. So, at first, no one stepped forward, so I simply smiled at my hands and waited without worry for their hesitation to give way as I knew it would. Unlike Wolf, a life of letters was nothing I was born to, and yet how entirely at home I felt in those grounds, that exercise. A long-married Dutch couple went to sit side by side where Leonard and Virginia played bowls during wartime, having to throw themselves to the ground sometimes when fighter planes came too low or crashed nearby. This husband and wife were giggling like children and hiding their paper from one another because I'd said I would post his to her the next day. It might even arrive back in Europe before them, but would make him wait a long, long time for hers. And I sent that couple a copy of the book, and the woman's now going through cancer treatment, and it's really precious to her that that time in the garden together has been captured in a book. And it's just at the heart of everything I do, having started so late and coming from the working class and achieved this, you know, really classic higher education. That was another thing that made this journey both late and difficult, but also wonderful. It was like, having achieved that so late, how do you create bridges across the culture for people? So everything I do is about showing the workings of a writer, having the same mystique of it. Like Wolf, I cultivate and de Beauvoir, and there's a passage in the book where I talk about studying our iconic writers and artists and creating an image for myself here at the pool. And Wolf had a very created, well, writerly identity, didn't she? She was very aware of her dress and how she was perceived. So everything I've done has been both, I'm serious about being treated as a real artist and writer, and I think I am now, but it's also, how do I make that accessible to people that may never have picked up a book before? And I did that at the pool, and I did it in Monk's House and all the other places I perform in public.
And that must be quite difficult, trying to write your life for yourself, but also to write it for other people and for their lives, and to trace not only in that your own experience, but the lives that gave birth to your experience. And what I really like about the passage you just read there was the way that you were grappling not only with the present moment, with this lovely few moments that you kind of gathered up in a snow globe for us, but with the influence of Wolf, who is not there, who is not in that moment, and that strange relationship with someone who you may feel that you probably may not have gotten on with very well if you actually met her. Mm. So there's an anxiety of influence there, and a difficulty of kind of legacy of your authorial inheritance. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And this whole business of privilege and class, and it's so interesting to me. I advocate very openly in public. I do a lot of free mentoring for working class writers. I took part in the first ever class festival last year, which was promoting working class voices. And yet I don't feel oppositional towards writers from a more privileged class, because that's just the circumstances of their birth. Wolf was born, I mean, she has some really unpleasant prejudices, as we know if we read her books and her diaries. I don't idolise Wolf. I see her limitations, her stigmatisms, her class constraints. She was constrained by her class in some ways. But what's interesting is to take those things and adapt them to our own conditions as writers and artists. I don't want everyone to have grown up with the cultural and economic constraints that I did. I wish I hadn't. It was a lot of wasted energy. But that's what I have to make art with. But yes, it's very interesting. It took me, well, that's probably why, again, it's late waking creative life. It took me a full quarter century after my higher education to find out how I could metabolize what I loved in the modernists, like Wolf and Eliot, but to tell a story that was authentic to my working class experience. And you know, also when you go to university and you're working class, you get educated out of your class, you don't belong anywhere. This all took a really long time for me, but I hope stories like mine that are now being told make that journey a bit quicker for people. That's my real work in the world now.
And I do think in some ways it's arguably a modernist project, you know, to tell a real life, to tell your life, to not try to be anything that you're not, and communicate truth ultimately to a wider audience.
Yeah. And that thing we see in the early modernist work about the breakdown of meaning, and and the suffering that comes with that. And my, that's a big thread through my book, is this almost compulsive making of meaning. I live in, you know, for me, as far as I'm concerned, a godless universe, and near death didn't change that, even though I experienced what felt like where religion comes from. And I say at the very beginning of the book, it's not my concern whether that thing I experienced, that oceanic, the sense of touching me universal, whether that was God or it was physics or it was biology, does not interest me. All I know was I touched something that felt full of meaning, and it was about slipping one's narrow skin. But then you're also fundamentally in a meaningless universe. So it's all the things that were playing out for the modernists. And it's like, this story is my version of that in the present moment, I think. Yeah, it's interesting how all those things I studied all those years ago became fully lived for me so late in life.
They do. The stories we read do become part of our stories in mysterious ways and wonderful ways. And I'm so thrilled that your story is now part of my story. And I hope that we can share it with some of our listeners at home as well. You can buy Tanya's wonderful book from all good bookshops, including Waterstones and Foyles. And if you'd like to attend online lectures on Virginia Woolf and learn a little bit more about her life, or on other writers, in fact, then head over to literaturecambridge.co.uk.